Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
All aboard this train is bound for glory. All aboard. Train is bound for glory. All aboard!
This train's a clean train. This train, no.
This train
is a clean train. This train, no. This train is a clean train. Everybody ride in my Jesus' name. This train is a clean train. This train.
This train.
This train is a clean train. This train.
This train.
Said this train is a clean train. Only way you ride, you got to be the same. Oh, Lord, talk about this train. I said this train don't count no liars. This train. This train don't count no liars. Ramblers. Hey, Lord, talking about this train. I said, this train is a holy train. This train.
This train.
This train is a holy train. This train.
This train.
Hey, this train is a holy train. Only way you ride, you got to be the same. Oh, Lord, talking about this train.
Good. Thank you. We have Stephanie Wilson on the line.
Yes, we have another guest on the line with us as well, sir.
Would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, this is Amafika Gayuka.
Stephanie, could you just introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Stephanie James Wilson. I'm the Executive Director of the New Jersey Amistad Commission out of the Department of State.
And she's in charge of the state program that is implemented to help New Jersey schools institute a Afrocentric curriculum. Am I correct, Stephanie?
Well, it's not exactly an Afrocentric curriculum that we're doing. What the state laws actually mandated, which was passed in 2002 with the General Assembly and the State Senate, basically dictated that United States History 1 and 2 and all of the social studies, which is taught K through 12, would mandatorily be infused with Afro-American history and content, which means that it is not creating for the state of New Jersey a separate coursework in Afro-American history and culture, but yet guaranteeing that in each and every instance that the students of the state of New Jersey are sitting in a United States history classroom or a social studies classroom or social studies instruction in the lower grades, that Afro-American content should and will be included. I mean, I think it's very important that the community actually knows all the work that the commission has done on behalf of the children in the state of New Jersey in all the districts. And it has been a long time coming. As I said, this law was passed in 2002. And, you know, we have primarily been focusing for the last couple of years in actually rewriting the social studies curriculum for the state. You know, I don't know how many parents are aware, but New Jersey is a standard state. There is no mandatory curriculum for any of the subject areas in New Jersey. What is required for teachers to be able to teach for instruction are standards, which basically are the benchmarks. They dictate that by the end of a certain year, there's a certain amount of facts that the students must know. How that translates to all the districts is that because the Department of Education sort of hands down from Trenton, all the different facts in all the different areas, not just in social studies, but in all the content areas, the districts have been able to design their own respective curriculums, or the counties design their own respective curriculums, which is what the instruction you see on a day-to-day basis in a classroom, as well as the lesson plans and things that the teachers follow throughout the year. What that means is that it becomes quite a daunting task when you're talking about over 619 school districts to begin to really instruct them unifinally on a one central idea in regards to what we think a content area should look like and what Afro-American history facts should be included and how they should be infused. But that was the mandate. And so our job really was to go through and rewrite United States History 1, United States History 2, with a few full infusion planned at the right spaces with the appropriate peoples, considering the appropriate stories, so that students that walk out of the classroom at the end of their 12th grade year get a very holistic and realistic portrait of history. They get a full array of knowing all the cast of characters that attribute to what we call American history. And without putting African Americans back into that story, we find quite frequently that students really have no idea of the agency, of the complexities, of the stories, of the histories. It definitively gives history a very jaded perspective without the contributions of African Americans. So that was primarily our job, which has been a very, very large task. We have since, over the last couple of years, been able to create a curriculum, and even moving forward with creating the curriculum, which, you know, can be used in whole or in part by any respective district, we took it even a step further, and because we realized that we're the first state to actually do this, decided that the curriculum needed to be web-based. So what we have been charged to do and what we will be able to do for all the teachers in September is that we will be the first state in the country to actually have a web-based social studies curriculum that will be available to each and every teacher in the state of New Jersey free of charge, with simply going in and being able to log into the system starting September 1. And it has a full plethora of lesson plans, templates, primary and secondary sources, assessments, rubrics for the classroom, document-based questions for the lower and higher grades, literacy connections, places to visit, resources, professional development methodologies, and pedagogy for teachers, you know, curriculum mapping for the higher grades, listing of textbooks or read-along and guided readings for the elementary grades that can be used not only in the classroom, but also for the teachers to be able to educate them on Afro-American content, on United States history, so that they can themselves be much more well-versed on how to sort of effectuate this sort of change, because we're looking at a real transformative movement in regards to how we are going to teach history in the state of New Jersey. So I hope
right.
I did not take too much of your time.
No,
that answer.
You
you're addressing me. I'm Afika Gayuka. Yes, I am back on the line.
Okay, great. Now, could you tell Stephanie and the listeners how committed you are to this curriculum that you have implemented in your school? First, tell us what school you're a part of.
Well, I'm a co-founder of the Joseph Littles and Guzzo Saba Charter School in West Palm Beach, Florida. We have the distinction of being the only African-centered public school of any sort, traditional or charter, in the entire state of Florida. We don't say that as a boast. We say that as an illustration of just how desperately behind the times we as a people are in terms of focusing on where we believe the education and development of our children should be.
So what is your take on what Stephanie is doing as far as infusing the African-American history with all of American history and even world history?
Typically, people who are favorably disposed towards African-centered education will be inclined to be supportive of any effort to legitimize the teaching of African history or black history, if you prefer, or for another way of looking at it, of teaching the proper role and contributions of people of African descent to the forward flow of human civilization. But having said that, there is a difference in approach between folks who are advocating infusion, and we have a an African and African-American infusion project in our school district as well in Palm Beach County, Florida. And we are also very much aware of perhaps the most successful such program in the country, and that is the one that Dr. Edward Robinson instituted in the Philadelphia school system, which has become somewhat of a model for other districts that take African or the proper teaching of African and Black American history very seriously. So, but we as practitioners of African-centered education do not see or choose to approach the education and development of black children as a sort of like an afterthought or in any way subordinated to the teaching of anybody else's history or heritage, et cetera. Our position is to teach from an African-centered perspective in much the same way as our Jewish counterparts teach that in their schools, and of course, as we all know, Catholics teach in Catholic schools, and of course, Catholics teach it from almost from birth to and including a graduate school, as long as the parents of the students can afford to pay tuition. So our approach, from an, in terms of what we refer to as African-centered education, puts the student of African descent at the center of his or her universe, and everything and everybody else revolves around them. They become the sun, the center of the universe, as it were, and everything else revolves around them, rather than them continuing to be viewed as we have historically in this country in particular as an afterthought almost.
Okay, I have to add something to your comment. I don't think you can have American history without African American history. There would not be American history if it wasn't for Africans being
in the country.
So there's there's no way I can accept the premise that by saying that Africans were in America and we make this country as great as it is today, that we're being
No, I agree. I think what we're really saying is that it's a different approach. I myself am a Afrocentrist at my core, and I absolutely believe in what you are saying. in regards to the instruction, I have two sons that I absolutely want to be placed in that center. I am a student of Dr. Malefe Asante at Temple University, where I did my doctoral work, and I absolutely understand in regards to the instruction for African-American children. I have two African-American males that I absolutely want to be instructed and taught in that manifestation. I think we're talking about a different approach because we're talking about a larger scale. The schools in New Jersey are diversified across socioeconomic, racial. There is a very few of them that have homogenous enough that we could take that large scale of approach in regards for the state system. And what we are talking about in New Jersey is not a particular building, but 619 school districts with probably more than 1,000 school buildings. And if you're talking about a K-12 instruction, and we are really talking about a complete revamping of how social studies instruction K-12 is taught in each and every one of the school buildings in the state of New Jersey, it became an impossibility to take that approach. It is not to say that the same content knowledge that would be approached in an Afrocentric education would not be included in the model that New Jersey is proposing under the Amistad legislation. The content knowledge is absolutely the same. The infusion plan or the plan for instruction changes a little bit. And I think that we should not be put ourselves in the position of saying one against the other. It is one model and another model, which I think can be a complement in either or situation. The infusion plan that we're proposing in New Jersey simply says that we want to make sure that that content is holistically infused and not included, not added on. We mean infused, so that that the historical landscape is so intertwined and interwoven with the Afro-American content that for any student coming through K-12, that content knowledge becomes a part of their regular instruction on a day-to-day basis, so that children of all hues, colors, class, and creeds in New Jersey will learn just as much about Nat Turner in class, that I will make sure, as an Afrocentric myself, my sons are taught at home. And that can translate to Hudson County, Warren County, Sussex County, Camden County, et cetera, and et cetera. Regardless if you have a classroom instruction where there is not a black student present at all, and whether or not there is not a black educator present at all, this legislation is mandating that this instruction is still taught in that manifestation as well. So I think we're really just talking about approaches, but I think we're all extremely passionate about making sure that the content is included, if I can make that assessment for you as well, sir.
Okay.
I'm not sure where we got off track here.
Let's get back on track. Now, here is to talk about your 1,000-mile walk. Do you want to talk about your walk?
Well, as you said, that was why you invited me, and that was what I intended to speak about. I didn't start the discourse in another direction.
Okay. Well, I apologize.
No, it's not a matter that you need to apologize. I just want to make sure we understand that I was at your service to talk about whatever you asked me to speak about. You asked me to respond to the issue of the infusion project, and I thought I did a reasonably coherent job of doing that by first and foremost acknowledging that perhaps all, I can't speak for everybody, of course, but certainly the vast majority of African-centered educators, theoreticians as well as practitioners, would be supportive of any initiative or effort to legitimize and give credibility to the proper and truthful teaching of the contributions of people of African descent to the forward flow of civilization. And some of us have an opportunity, as the young lady has had, to do that on a much larger scale in terms of attempting to infuse that into the entire public school system throughout the state of New Jersey, and we certainly, and I personally, would applaud that. I said, however, that that was a different approach, just as she herself has indicated, to what those of us who are practitioners of the implementation of African-centered education for children of African descent, that's a different approach. Not to say that we're judging hers or that we expect her to judge ours. It's just that there's a different approach, as she herself has indicated.
And I absolutely echo, sir, and if that is what you thought that I meant, it is absolutely not. I applaud your efforts. I think it is wonderful. I was just illustrating it is simply two sides of the same coin, and I wanted to make sure that the listeners were aware of that, because I think that I know you and I are absolutely in concert with this, but I think there's a larger audience that might not understand that we are both talking about the same content knowledge, the same sort of, you know, consideration for our students. It's simply two different approaches.
Right. I think I was the one who, like he said, I brought everybody off the wrong track. And I really want the audience to know that our guest is extremely dedicated, to the extent he's walking 1,000 miles for his charter school. So if we can start all over from your 1,000-mile walk, and just tell the audience, when did this thought come into your mind that this is a great way to gain some kind of awareness for your struggle, for your cause with this curriculum?
Well, the idea, and I would like to think, and I'm sure the sister can relate to this, that the idea came from the creative spirit and the ancestors to do something sufficiently dramatic as to at least have the potential to capture the imagination of responsible adult black people in this country and have them step up to the plate and accept responsibility for reclaiming the direction of education and development for our children. We have relinquished that responsibility to the public education system in the main. And then we more or less exercise our right to pass judgment on how good or not so good a job they're doing of educating and developing our children. Our position is that black folks, responsible black folks, need to reclaim the responsibility and accept being held accountable for reclaiming the direction that our children's education and development takes. And for that reason, we feel that African-centered education should be recognized and accepted as being no less valid for children of African descent than people routinely concede that a Jewish-centered education is valid for and indeed from their standpoint absolutely necessary for children of Jewish descent. And as I mentioned earlier, so do Catholics view it the same way. It's only when we talk about an African-centered education for children of African descent that people tend to want to view that as being somehow or other potentially at least, reverse racism or racism in reverse. They don't raise those kind of charges against anyone else. So our position is that the approach of using African-centered education for children of African descent has to be legitimized and given credibility, and none of us should be in a position of having to be ashamed or embarrassed about acknowledging the fact that we are black, we're African people, and that we have a point of view with respect to how education should work that is no less valid than anyone else's.
Historically speaking, has African Americans ever governed their own schools?
Well, to begin with, African Americans created what we call today generally public education. Earlier, as the sister knows, there was no public education per se. Formal education was the privileged purview, and then even there, the male progeny of the landed gentry or the landed class of people in this country. They could send their heirs apparent to foreign schools in either England or France, or usually in England, but wherever they wanted to send them. And, of course, as you both know, their fee- females they sent to finishing schools where they were trained primarily to be good, honorable wives to these favorite sons of these people. So they didn't have public education. What we now look at as public education was actually started by the black church, and it was started as in very much the vein of African collectivism and communalism. They provided education. They made sure that the teachers were received the training they needed and that the teachers were provided for, whether that was a salary, which it seldom was, or whether that was those things that were necessary for one to live reasonably well given the circumstances. So it was after it began, folks began to realize that, in fact, black children, or the descendants of Africans in this country, were in effect getting a better and stronger grounding in formal education than even their white counterparts, that folks took a look at this thing and decided to appropriate this advent of ours. And now we look upon public education as something that the other people have started and done. But initially, not only did we control the education of our children within reason, of course, but we also were the people who created this system of public education or general education for all comers who were willing to make whatever sacrifices they had to make in order to obtain that education. So, yes, the answer to your question is absolutely there was a time. It did not happen back until after Brown versus the Board of Education was passed into law, that the whole idea of blacks being in direct charge of the education of black children was abrogated and appropriated by the system as such.
I would like to echo that, just to say that, you know, and it is no reflection on your question, Leslie, but I think this is exactly such a challenging, we really recognize how far we've come by the notions that we questioning ourselves. In 2009, the idea of agency among African and African American people has always been our beckoning call. We have done everything, and I think the reality is that we've moved so far away from even beginning to understand the vast accomplishments and contributions we've made, especially in the education of our children, that would be a question that people would ask, because it is not what we see, you know, heir apparent around today. But, you know, just as the gentleman has said, you know, the whole notion of educating our children, we lived in enclaves. And I think, you know, there's a difference between what we, you know, consider segregation and what we do by choice, or what we do.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, we think of an area of African American enclave only as a negative. But there were plenty of very strong and wonderful, you know, African-American enclaves where we educated our children, where we ran businesses and stores and all of that. And that part of our history we have not reclaimed for our children in a great deal, for them to really understand what our agency has been and continues to be. And so I absolutely applaud you for, you know, for your trek, because, you know, to do that in support of your school, you know, please let us know what we can do for you in New Jersey, because that is a wonderful, wonderful endeavor.
Great. Well, now, could you talk about schools such as Wilberforce and Oberlin, just to give our listeners the history of blacks in education prior to the Civil War in a Reconstruction era?
I would say that, you know, when you look specifically at education, it's not always that you're looking at, you know, the Oberlins. I mean, most of the land-grant colleges, most of the colleges were founded, you know, specifically either by the church organizations or specifically for African-American coming out of the Freedmen's Bureau after Reconstruction. But I would actually point back even further to the first African school in Boston, which actually, if I'm remembering correctly, was actually done by Prince Hall Mason for their education of their children in Boston. It was one of the first public schools dedicated specifically from an African American community for the education of American children. And that, of course, is in Boston. and I believe it's in the late 1700s or the early 1800s. So as you can see, there's been a long history, especially among African Americans, of being making sure that we were concerned and had agency around the education of our own children. And that is in complete concert with the rise of the abolitionist movement and everything else. You know, we need not only look to 2007 to see where African Americans have very much claimed and declared themselves that they want to make sure that our children are getting the fullness of their experiences.
Okay, we can even go as far as back as 1700s with the free African school that was established in New York City in Harlem with the help of Alexander Hamilton and the black church, and so was Wilberforce in Ohio. These schools existed in the 1700s. So you could go ahead, Doctor.
I just wanted to add to what the sister said, and I agree with her 100%. The addition is to point out that while the founding of schools by various, shall we call them, progressive white elements of society is commendable, obviously, because those did in fact contribute in many ways to the general development and advancement of our people. So we certainly are not going to look a gift horse in the mouth in that respect. But there is another difference that the sister was referring to that's very important for us to note, and that is that those educational initiatives, and that would include Wilberforce and Oberlin, you name it, if it was started by the system, they generally were starting those schools for purposes of preparing black people to provide services to the white-controlled system. So whatever it was that they felt that would be the new way that blacks could serve America, that's what those schools were founded to teach or to condition, as the case may be. Whereas the schools that were started by blacks ourselves, and I give credit to the black church for originating most of those, though, as the sister said, the Prince Hall Mason started the first free African school in the United States, or in the colonies as they were at that time. And so though, but along with the church schools and those that were started by non-church but perhaps church-affiliated entities such as the Prince Hall Masons, they were started for the purpose of educating black children from a black perspective, not just to prepare them to be good imitations of white people.
Okay, when I mentioned Wilberforce was started by black ministers. It was, and it was not founded after the Reconstruction era. I agree with you wholeheartedly that the Reconstruction era schools were founded mainly by the white system, for maybe the purposes you said, or maybe not. But
each one of them had their own respective history. So I mean, to make a generalization, there's the land grants, there's the one, you've got your Cheney's, you've got your Lincoln's, you've got your Howard's. You know, you've got your A&M's, you've got your Tuskegee's. Each one of them have a respective history, each with their own sort of ideology behind it and sort of why it was founded. I think what it becomes even more important is that we recognize that agency and education among African Americans is not a new nuance.
Right.
It is as old of a history as we have been in the Americas. You know,
and that leads me to my next question. We mentioned that the most successful entity to help African Americans in the realm of education was fostered by the church. How has the church received your charter school, and have they been supported?
The answer is no.
Okay, so how did you go about soliciting some support from them?
My good sister, fellow guest, and I apologize for not remembering your name, Doctor. But I also want to say that you and I share Dr. Malifi Asante. I know Dr. Asante personally. We've known each other for a number of years, and I'm very very much appreciative of the good work that he's doing up there at Temple University and turning out folks like yourself. So I'm not ignorant of the fact that y'all have got some good, solid stuff going on up there, and I'm pleased to know that you come out of that continuum. But the point that to respond to what the sister is saying, I know you would be familiar, for example, with a book by Dr. Gayrard Wilmore, where he talks about the pre and post slavery church, or the pre and post church that followed the so-called end of slavery, if in fact slavery did end. And there was a different church that founded those initial schools, my sister, as opposed to the church that we have today. And that's not to put a knock on all of them. It's just to say that there's a difference in the general attitude towards what it means to be black and what the church's role is or should be in the forward development of our people, so that the black church today is more about the religion that it is attached to than it is about using the religion as a tool to advance the cause of our people.
Well, you're correct. I don't know about the book that you just mentioned, but I do know that slavery is attached to money, and if you're seeking money from the state or any political organization, then you are still enslaved. So if you want to make an example of being free, then you need to cut your strings from the system and fund your own school with your own private money, like the Jewish schools that you've been talking about and the Catholic schools, and don't rely on the government.
Well, I'll even take it a step further in looking at sort of the history. Our communities are deteriorating, and I think the reality is that when you look at the church as it comes out of slavery, and as it is still the central nexus for the Afro American community prior to integration and all of the flights from the communities and neighborhoods in which the church was the pivotal part, the cords that sort of held neighborhoods together. They were the social, they were the political, they were the religious, they were the center and the nexus of so many things. And because of that, they also took a supreme responsibility for education. I think that with the onset of integration, with the onset of the movement of our community, the church's responsibility has fallen primarily, in most people's eyes, to religion. They don't think of them as contingencies on the neighborhood. They don't see the connectiveness. They don't see them as places where we take our children to be educated. We don't, Sunday school is not what it once was. You know, you don't see, the preacher in the school building the way you once did. There was a interconnectedness to all aspects of African American life that sprung from the Afro American church that we do not see. And so there seems to be a disconnect in the church's support, in some instances, of educational institutions in the surrounding neighborhoods, and making sure that what is instructed to those students, that those parents that sit in those pews, is relevant in their lives, is contingent on making sure that, it prepares them for, at this point, the 21st century, and beyond. And, and I think that is absolutely a problem, and it's one of the great losses in regards to a major institution for Afro-American content and study over the last 400-plus years in this country.
Okay.
Once again, I agree.
Thank you, Dr. Stephanie James.
Not yet finished. I know Dr. Stephanie would probably kill me. I know that this is a long time in making, but, we're almost there. I will come back, Dr. Santa, I promise I will finish the doctoral work. One of the things that you find very often is that you get all the way to the end, you take a job, you get married, you have children, and you leave that last part out. But God willing, that was something I will go back and absolutely complete, because I know he will not rest until he makes sure that all of us that came under his tutelage have finished everything that he started in us. So
well,
I thank you very much for the accolades.
But I hope you remain humble once you
Absolutely.
Receive that doctorate, because right now your spirit is so humble, and I think
this is a position of service, and I hear it, brother, I hear it in you too. I think anybody who becomes very active in understanding that we are about educating our children understands that the legacy is beyond us, and my position in taking this job and doing this is to really make sure that I can effectuate some change for those little boys that live in my house. And if I, at the grade, you know, grade second and fourth grade, can make sure that by they graduate, they have the benefit of me. There are a lot of children that do not have the benefit of a parent that is able to teach them at home. And it is a sin and a shame that so many of our children only get the content as an ancillary when they come home because someone is trying to either reteach or ancillary teach all that is going on in the classroom. That is my purpose in the state of New Jersey. I mean, that is really the major reason. And if, God forbid, if the children don't look like me or my children, and they come home and there's no one to even begin to do the undoing or begin to fill in the holes and gaps for them, that's why it's just so necessary. You know, so I appreciate that. It is not about, you know, it will never be about me. It will always be about making sure we can provide for the teachers and making sure that the children that come down the pike very much are changed and shifted by what we're able to do. And if we can do that right, then I can rest assured, and I hope my Savior will one day say, well done, my good and faithful servant, and that'll be enough for me. It really will.
Right. I knew the answer before you said it. Dr. Akuk, I can't pronounce your name, so I apologize again.
Like the sister, I'm not a doctor.
Okay.
I accept the term that many of my friends and associates have affectionately given me as Baba, which is a word that means father in Swahili
mm-hmm.
language. So I don't profess to have a doctorate. It's Baba Gayuka is what most people refer to me as, and I accept that.
All right, Baba. I think what we understood from this conversation, what I learned, because that's what I'm here for, is to learn and to help teach the audience as much as I can from listening to people like yourself who are actively involved and who are on the front lines. So what I've learned is that you two have different audiences, and I think your audience, Abba, is an audience of primarily African-American children, whereas Stephanie's audience is the whole broad state of New Jersey. And I think if you two were to switch positions, you would do the same exact thing for those
students.
So I just wanted to clear that up before the show is over. Now, is there a website or any information that anybody can go to if they want to support what you're doing, Abba?
Well, we have a website, very much so, and we encourage people to visit that website to learn more about what we're doing. The website address is www.jlnscs.org. That's www.jlnscs.org.
Okay, now, where did your journey start?
Pardon?
What town or city, state did your journey for this walk-a-thon begin?
West Palm Beach, Florida.
Okay. And where are you now? How far has it taken you?
As we're speaking, I'm in Petersburg, Virginia.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. You're getting closer and closer.
About 20 miles or so south of Richmond, Virginia.
Okay. Can you explain to us the logistics of your walk-a-thon? Like how are you going about reaching your goal? And, you know, what is your goal?
Well, of course, the distance from our school, the site of our school in West Palm Beach, to Malcolm X Park in Washington, D.C., is 1,069 miles. And we were determined that we would need to cover that distance in 1 month or 4 weeks. And that would mean that in order to cover that distance, we would have to cover approximately, on average, 33 to 35 miles a day, and that is what we have done thus far. There were some days when we did less miles than that, other days that we did a little bit more than that, but for the most part, in order for us to have succeeded in covering that distance within the time frame that we had set for it, we would have to average approximately 33 to 35 miles a day.
Okay, now when you mention we, who are you referring to when you say we?
Good question. There are two people who have accompanied me all the distance on this this walkathon or this trek, as we also call it. My colleague, who was also a co-founder of our school, Mawusi Hazard, has come along to serve in several capacities. He is the driver, for one thing. He drives the follower van. We have a van that follows me as I walk or goes ahead of me so that we can get out of bad weather or whatever the case may be. And he also is my surrogate walker, which means that when I need a break, he will actually get out and walk, and then I will drive the van while he walks. So he walks for me when I need a break from the rigors of, 10, 12-hour days of walking. The other person, he is also, incidentally, unofficially, our videographer. He also videotapes certain things along the way so that at some point we'll probably put together a documentary of this trek. The other person accompanying us is a young lady who is a professional photographer, and she is the official photographer recording the trek or the walkathon by still photography. So those are the two people I refer to when I say we.
Okay. Now, are you getting any support from your students? Because when I checked you out on the internet, I've seen photos of, it looks like, you and some of the students that attend your school.
Yes, the students and some of the parents and, of course, the staff at the school and some other community folks joined us on the day that we launched out on this walk. And, in fact, the children walked with us for perhaps the first quarter of a mile until we hit the busy street. We weren't going to subject the children to walking down, even on the sidewalk in busy streets, because that's too dangerous. From that point, several of the teachers and parents and other supporters from the community accompanied me for varying distances along the way, and there were about a half a dozen brothers and one sister who accompanied me for the entire first, I would say, what we call the first leg of the walkathon, which was the distance from our school to the county line, the end of our county, at the beginning of the next county north of us, and that was a distance of 19 miles. So about 10 people, a group of about 10 people, accompanied me for that entire distance. Beyond that, the numbers began to thin out, of course, to the extent that we then got down to the point where it was just Mr. Hazard, Ms. Neptune, and myself, with Mr. Hazard and I doing the walking.
Great. Now, I asked you earlier, when did this idea come to you that, bingo, I think a walkathon will absolutely bring awareness to...
Approximately 4 months ago. It wasn't that long ago. As I said, I was out. I walk regularly, at least 5 or 6 days a week for, 5 miles or so. So that's why it was not much of a big deal for me to undertake to do this, because I didn't have any doubt that I could do it. But I was out on my walk one day, and I usually meditate while I'm walking in addition to the physical exercise. And this thought came to me that I should walk from West Palm Beach to Washington, D.C. to dramatize the need for an African-centered education for children of African descent. And from that point, I began to share those ideas and that thought with some people that I know, all of whom were shocked initially and weren't sure that I was serious, but as they began to realize that I was in fact serious, the idea began to grow on them, and enough of them decided to lend their support to me and help me organize the event, to the extent that we now, it has become an actuality, and as you know, we are now within striking distance of Washington, D.C.
Okay, now earlier in the conversation, you mentioned a Afrocentric, I think, school or principal. Are you getting any support from your fellow Afrocentric educators?
Oh, by all means. In fact, I'm glad you raised that, because you did mention that the one of the purposes of the walkathon is to raise money for our school, because it is important for us to develop the capacity to financially underwrite our own educational institutions so that we can be in total control of them. So there's no question that one of the major points of emphasis for this walkathon is to raise a substantial amount of money, we would hope, to support our school in its move towards autonomy and self-determination. The other purpose, though, and perhaps a greater purpose, is that we are doing this to advance and elevate the importance of African-centered education per se. In that respect, then, we're talking about helping all of our fellow practitioners of African-centered education, as well as our esteemed theoreticians, such as, for example, Dr. Malifi Asante, Dr. Maulana Karenga, and others, who, of course, give us what we use to apply in the classrooms. They develop the theories and write the books and develop the curriculums, and then we practitioners put those things into practice at the school level. So what we're doing is being supported by brothers and sisters who are African-centered practitioners around the country, as well as, if you have a chance to visit our website and see the fact sheet, you will note on our flyer that Dr. Malifi Asante's name is there, along with Dr. Maulana Karenga and several others, as honorary national co-chairpersons of this African-centered, or this trek to support African-centered education.
Great answer. Do you have any comments to make, Stephanie, or any questions for
him? Absolutely applaud you. I love the symbolism of ending in Malcolm X Park. Exactly when, what day do you anticipate arriving?
My schedule is to arrive in Washington a week from today, on Wednesday, August the 12th. And the following day, Thursday, August 13th, is the big day. We are hopeful that there will be hundreds, if not thousands, of folks who will converge on Washington, D.C. on that day to participate in the activities that are scheduled to take place. The major activities that are the main reason for the gathering in Malcolm X Park will, of course, be to celebrate the culmination of this 1,000-plus-mile journey that we will have completed. And there will be speeches among the people who have been invited to speak on that day. In fact, would be Dr. Malifi Asante, among others. And then included in the day's activities will be a walk by those people who assemble in the park to the White House, or to the vicinity of the White House, and a second stop in the vicinity of the U.S. Department of Education. At both stops, there will be proclamations read, directed to, of course, first the President of the United States, Barack Obama, and secondly to the Secretary of Education, his Secretary of Education, Mr. Arne Duncan. And the purpose of that will be that we're calling on the President of the United States and the Secretary of Education to themselves acknowledge publicly that an African-centered education for children of African descent is no less valid and appropriate than we readily accept, and a Jewish-centered education is for Jewish children, a Catholic-centered education is for Catholic children, and you can say that across the board with other racial, ethnic, nationality groups.
Now, how has the press received you? Have you been getting any national press?
Not that I know of. We have been getting some press from some affiliates of some of the networks. Most particularly, we have gotten coverage by some NBC affiliates. We get most of the coverage that we got, for example, when we started the trek, or before we started the trek in West Palm Beach, came from the local NBC affiliate there. But we also got some coverage from the ABC affiliate. But most of it, and the best of it, was from us from the local NBC affiliate. We also got some excellent coverage from the NBC affiliate in Savannah, Georgia. And I'm scheduled, according to Mr. Roger Madison, who coordinates these things, to be interviewed tomorrow morning by, I guess it's the NBC affiliate or a reporter from the NBC affiliate in Richmond. But they will come here, I understand, to where I am, which is in Petersburg, to do that interview.
Okay. Well, we started off pretty rocky, I admit, But we're ending on a high note, and I want to get while the getting is good, as they say. And
I don't think we start off rocky at all. I think the reality is that you have people that are impassioned about education, and because of that, there is no rocky start. It is only the passion that will translate to the kids. That's
okay.
The bottom line.
Thank you.
And I commend you.
There's also the old saying that all is well that ends well.
Okay. Absolutely.
All right, so I would like for both of you, before we officially end the show tonight, for you to give your information, your mission statement, your information, and your contact information, and then we're going to call it a night.
Let me start,
Stephanie?
That's fine. Thank you very much. I'm Stephanie James Wilson. The New Jersey Amistad Commission is located at 225 West State Street in Trenton, New Jersey, 08625. Our phone number is area code 609-826-5326. The New Jersey Amistad web-based curriculum's address, which will open free of charge, as I said, to each and every teacher in the state of New Jersey and will be the first in the country to do so, is www.njamistad.com/org/net. We have them all, just in case anybody's confused. And so Amistad curriculum is one word. And, brother, I commend you. Keep on walking. I might meet you in D.C. if I can get there.
I would certainly hope so. And, in fact, that is what we would encourage people to do. I am Baba Amafika Gayuka, co-founder of the Joseph Littles and Guzzo Saba Charter School, and the primary walker on this walkathon or trek of 1,069 miles from West Palm Beach, Florida, to Malcolm X Park in Washington, D.C. And our web address is www.jlnscs.org. And we encourage everyone in the listening audience to visit the website. It is a comprehensive website. It gives you all the data and details about not only the school, but the walkathon, the whys and the wherefores. And you can actually, it's updated on a daily basis, so you can find out exactly where we are at any given point in time and how we are progressing towards the culmination of this march. And like the sister Stephanie said, I would love for all of you in the sound of our voice to plan on converging with us on Washington, D.C., especially on the 13th of August, which is when we will have what we call African-Centered Education Elevation Day with the acronym ACEED. And we're talking about planting a seed. African-Centered Education Elevation Day in Washington, D.C. at Malcolm X Park. Y'all come.
Well, thank you for both of you. Thank both of you for coming and joining me at the show, the Antique E Show, tonight. And I look forward to talking to you again. And have a good night.
I find a quiet place, just a small, simple space, just to thank you, Lord, for your blessings. I know that deep in my heart, I'm no good when we part. So here's my love to you. Thank you. I find a quiet place, just a small, simple space, just to thank you, Lord, for your blessings. I know that deep in my heart, I'm no good when we part. So here's my love to you. Thank you. I find a quiet place, just a small, simple space, just to thank you, Lord, for your blessings. I know that deep in my heart, I'm no good when we part. So here's my love to you. Thank you.
Thank you for visiting the Antique E Show. We look forward to having you a part of the show. on Sundays at 6 p.m. This is Leslie Gist. Bye-bye.